Welcome to session 6 of the Practice of the Yoga Sutra Book Study Club, Yamas, Niyamas, and Their Siddhis. So last session, we began our study of the eight limbs. And we explored a few very important things that are relevant for tonight, because tonight really is a continuation of the last session. It's this similar subject matter, but an expansion of it. We looked at the eight limbs being a path of yoga, which allows us to transform, purify our impurities. And more specifically, the path of yoga which allows us to work with our kleshas, afflictions. And a very important statement was made, that as we transform these kleshas, these afflictions, we are able to experience our essential self nature. Essentially, by purifying ourself of the kleshas, we put ourselves on the path to samadhi, experiencing that essence of ourself, the best in ourself. The whole idea being that that essential capacity within is always there. We simply need to remove the veils which cover it, rather than to create something from scratch. That's who we are. So working with the eight limbs to transform who we are really is at the heart of yoga. And that led us to look at the yamas and niyamas, the first two limbs of the eight limbs. And at first glance, these yamas and niyamas, it seems like, is this just like introduction, something just to kind of get things going, but the real heart of yoga is the practice. So what do the yamas and niyamas really have to do with anything? Are they really that important? And the answer is absolutely yes. It requires us to transform how we see the yamas and niyamas. And really to think about how practice is much more than what we do with ourselves in the practice space. There's something more essential happening here. In Sutra 233, we looked at this concept of pratipaksha bhavana, which really is at the heart of how you put the yamas and niyamas into practice. Yamas and niyamas at face value are a set of ethical codes. They're a set of principles that help us to transform our relationship with the world. It's kind of like how yoga's code of conduct. And often when we think of ethical principles, it's a very passive phenomenon. All the stuff that we shouldn't do. And literally, in the translation of restraints, it seems like it's things to avoid, which is one of the ways that the word yamas is translated as. But it's very important to see the yamas and niyamas as an active practice. They're not passive characteristics that we're trying to cultivate in ourselves, but rather, they're a highly active practice, a state of mind, an attitude, an identity that we're trying to cultivate and put into practice. If we see the yamas and niyamas as a passive phenomenon, their impact will be passive. They'll help us in some way, but they don't really become a catalyst for our transformation. They're not really yamas and niyamas as an integral part of this living body of practice that we call the eight limbs. So for yamas and niyamas to be living limbs of the eight limbs of our practice, a living part of our practice, we have to bring them to life. That's what 233 was all about, pratipaksha bhavana, that when we're working to transform something within ourselves, when we're trying to bring change, the attitude that we cultivate has to be as active as whatever it is that we're trying to counteract. It's in a simple law of physics that to counteract a force, you need to apply an equal force but an opposite direction. There has to be intensity. If we're trying to transform any tendency of violence in ourselves, we can't passively hope that it goes away just because we want to be peaceful, but rather we need to have a very dynamic, active, willful force of peace to counteract any violence within or without, as an example. So Pratipaksha Bhavana 233 gave us the introduction to the idea that the yamas and niyamas are a highly active practice. That as we begin to look at these, we reflect on what they mean. And we might not practice all of them at once with that degree of intensity, but whatever we do choose to work on, we should work on with engagement. And when we engage with it, we begin to see them, these principles, transform from principles into a living practice and become an integral part of the eight limbs. And it's very intriguing that when you look at the sutras that we're about to cover, there's more time spent on these yamas and niyamas than on any of the other limbs, which is quite intriguing. And a substantial amount of time is spent on the unique capacities or siddhis that the practice of the yamas and niyamas can bring us. And many of these appear to be quite extraordinary. These extraordinary qualities of the yamas and niyamas emerge in response to the intensity, focus, and longevity of our practice of a specific yama or niyama. These siddhis, these accomplishments, don't come out of thin air. They're a living reality that emerges through our practice. One of the questions that obviously comes up is, how does all this work? We'll delve into each of the yamas and niyamas and the capacities that they engender. But we ask ourselves, is that really possible? Or is that just good marketing so that we're inspired to practice the yamas and niyamas? How does that really work? And it's a very important question, because the more clear we are on how and why a practice works, the more likely it is that we really engage with it. So go back to the fundamental point of the eight limbs in the first place, to transform our kleshas. We're working with the eight limbs, not with the immediate goal of samadhi, certainly not with any immediate goal of extraordinary yogic capacities, but because we know that something is veiling our intrinsic capacity. Something is getting between me as whatever it means to be a human being and my deepest source of power, my deepest pulsation of awareness, whatever that might be called. Yoga calls that buddhi, light of consciousness. But whatever that is, something is in between whatever brings me to life and my experience of life. That much I know. I know that I'm alive, but I really don't know how I'm alive. And I don't know what that pulsation of life is all about, other than what I experience. All these myriad of experiences in life are wonderful, but I also know that they're not life itself. It's an expression of life. I want to know what that is. Kleshas, all of these identities, are like a veil between that pure light of consciousness and our experience of it. As we thin that veil, as we work with that, we get closer to that source of power. As we get closer to that source of power, extraordinary things begin to happen. That unveiling of our inner capacity is the dawning of siddhis. That's really at the heart of the sutras that we'll cover in this session. The source of these powers is not our practice. Our practice reveals a deeper capacity that was always there, but a capacity that we receive from our source. We spent a lot of time talking about this three sessions ago, when we looked at Purusha and Prakriti. So these siddhis, these accomplishments, are a gift of our own Prakriti, our self-nature. We don't create them, but we receive them. And we have to earn the right to be able to contain them. It's really our ability to see it and contain it. That's what these yamas and niyamas are all about. And that's very important, because when we realize that we're receiving a gift, it helps us to maintain the right attitude towards it. Our ego is kept in check. It's not like developing a worldly skill where I'm the doer, I'm the one who really worked hard, I achieved it, and it's mine. The reason why that's important is that we won't drown in these siddhis then. We'll be able to genuinely use them for some higher purpose. The last thing I'll say about where they come from. We spent a lot of time looking at this beautiful Sutra 223, which talked about the union of our Shakti and the Shakti of Ishwara. So when we start reflecting on what that means, that we're trying to find a union, a yoga, of our capacity and the power of infinite capacity, power of Shakti of Purusha, Ishwara, then we begin realizing that nothing is impossible. And what we consider to be extraordinary capacities today are actually completely like a mundane reality to that higher reality. So the source of to us it's extraordinary, but the goal we're trying to shoot for is an extraordinary one. So along the way, we'll receive many gifts. It's important to realize that these are gifts, they're not our creation. And it's important not just so that our head doesn't become big. Without that attitude, we won't even be able to receive the gift in the first place. So to achieve the siddhis that the yamas and niyamas can give us, we need to work hard, meaning we need to engage ourselves in an intense, sincere, and consistent practice of the yamas and niyamas and the overall eight limbs. But we need to realize that we're trying to experience something which is at our very core and which is a gift that we've received. Then we'll be able to contain it. Otherwise, our capacity to receive it will be highly limited. So we'll begin with 235, where we left off last time. Ahimsa, the very first of the yamas. Last time we talked about the definition of ahimsa being quite a bit more profound than nonviolence. That the definition that we read that comes from the commentary by Vyasa is that ahimsa is non-animosity towards all living beings all the time and in every respect. Extremely profound and expansive definition. That it's a state of mind where any sense of animosity has been transformed and removed. We're completely at peace with every living being. And what that really means is that we've started to experience a sense of oneness. Nothing outside of us is a threat to our identity. That's how we're able to be at peace with those other beings. We talked about how violence, which is the opposite of ahimsa, is simply a response to any threat to our identity. It's a reaction to fear. When we're afraid, we think, speak, or act in a violent way to defend ourselves. So ahimsa is a state, a highly profound, mature state of fearlessness. It's a process. Even aspiring to first not act violently is wonderful. Then it's wonderful to aspire to not speak violently. And ultimately, the hardest, we aspire to not think in any violent manner. It's a lifelong process. It's a living practice that keeps maturing. But what 235 tells us is that in the company of a yogi established in nonviolence, highly established in ahimsa, in thought, speech, and action, in the company of such a yogi, animosity vanishes. It's almost a little bit too subtle to grasp initially. What does that mean and why is it so important? Why that's so unique and why it's considered an accomplishment is that, of course, for that yogi, they're already abiding in a state of ahimsa, within and without. They're free from all animosity. What this sutra is saying is that even being in the presence, even if we still haven't reached that far, even if we're quite largely under the influence of fear in where we respond in a violent way potentially, just by being in that bubble of awareness that kind of yogi exudes, our animosity disappears. And what this tells us is that degree of establishment in ahimsa transforms the yogi within and without and influences the space around them. It's such a potent concentration of nonviolence that the space is saturated with that kind of experience. That kind of yogi becomes a treasure for all of creation. It's like, imagine a desert, and if there is a spring of water, that oasis is treasured. It's an extraordinary resource that everyone is grateful for. In a world filled with fear and violence, a small bubble of reality where our latent or full-blown tendencies towards violence, if they can vanish, that's the biggest gift that we can give to ourselves, that we can give to nature. So these kind of yogis, whether they're seen or unseen, are a tremendous source of strength to nature, to creation, to human civilization. Humanity, if it operates under the pressure of fear, won't last very long as a civil society. It'll degrade into a very barbaric, fear-driven kind of collection of pseudo-human beings. And we see that in some places. War-torn, lawless states. It's called stateless states, places where the rule of law is disintegrated. When you go to places like that, places sometimes Africa, Asia, Central America, truly third world environments, it's such a dense space of consciousness that it's hard to even live there because you're always under a sense of fear. And it's very hard to reverse that process. A yogi established in ahimsa can start to become a force to transform that. And this has something to do with collective consciousness, that kind of powerful experience of ahimsa transforms collective consciousness and allows other human beings to begin walking on the path of ahimsa. Even if other people don't even consider themselves to be yogis, and certainly are far away from practicing ahimsa in thought or speech, at least their actions become a little bit less violent or nonviolent. This kind of practice of ahimsa is what every yogi aspires to do so that they can serve creation and serve humanity. It's like you become a resource for everyone around you to find that stability within. It's a tremendous, tremendous siddhi. 236. When a yogi is established in truthfulness, actions begin to bear fruit. This is the practice of satya. We talked about satya not just being not lying. Truthfulness is not the same as not lying. Truthfulness means that our thought, speech, and action are fully aligned. We say what we think and we do what we say. Or in some cases, skips the speech, we do what we think. It's that clear. Really, what this means is that there is a much deeper force of purpose and intention, sankalpa, that holds our thought, speech, and action together. It's not just not lying, but rather satya has something to do with thinking, speaking, and acting purposefully. Not just habitually, not unconsciously, but there's some deeper reason why we are thinking, speaking, and acting. It holds all of it together. That's the essence of this sutra, that when there's a sankalpa, a clear and potent intention that manifests in our thought, speech, and action directly, then our actions bear fruit. When we mean what we say and what we do, we're able to actually materialize our will. And that's a very big thing again. You know, long before there were contracts, you were only as good as your word. And it's an ancient thing. For thousands of years, people had great respect and regard for the power of word. Now we've slightly lost that because we know that unless it's in writing and unless both party sets of lawyers have signed off on it, it might not be true. So the definition of satya has been radically changed. Right now, it's true as long as it's not proven to be false. It's in this idea of We'll come back to that later as far as what's stealing or non-stealing, but a similar kind of logic will apply there. So here we need to transform our attitude towards truth to not see it any relative standard. We're not talking about truth as defined by any external arbiter, but an experience of truth within, which is where it boils down to your intention, your degree of knowledge. When you know what you mean and you believe it and you follow through, your actions bear fruit. You will be able to manifest your will. Huge accomplishment. So much of life, and so often in life, we're frustrated because we're not able to see our actions through and see anything come of them. And imagine a society that's built on this, where people are truthful. You can achieve greatness. When you live in a society where people are not truthful, nothing really seems to ever change, and you can't accomplish anything. Satya is a principle upon which great civilizations are built. And the lack of satya is one which leads civilizations to decline, sometimes precipitously. 237. When a yogi is established in non-stealing, all gems manifest. So this is the practice of asteya. So it's interesting, again, because we're saying non-stealing. So it implies that as long as you're not stealing something, you're good. You've successfully practiced this. But Patanjali means something much more. We have to really understand what is ours in the first place to make sure that we're not stealing. Because the active process of stealing, where we're the ones actually taking something which is not ours, not lawfully defined to be ours, that's quite straightforward. But so often, in our modern day and age, unless it belongs to someone else, it's anyone's, and it's mine to claim. Finders keepers, right? So this is very different. Truly reflecting on what is mine, and did I earn it? Non-stealing means certainly refraining from actually taking, but even more so from desiring that which is not mine, that which I did not earn through my purpose-driven action. Accidentally bumping into something and hitting the lottery and claiming it as mine is actually theft. In that regard, so much of our modern economic model, where the smarter you are and the more capable you are of manipulating loopholes, taking advantage of someone's lack of awareness about something or something, which allows you to earn money, would be all falling under the category of stealing. You know, it's funny because it's, again, such a simple truth that culturally is understood. Was it an honest day's work? Did I do anything? Did I actually earn whatever I received today or not? It's super simple. And yet, it's become very convoluted because so much of our livelihood is so... There's so many layers of abstraction between what we actually do and what's produced, and who even knows what we do half of the time. It's quite confusing, shuffling things from here and there, and before you know it, you know, wealth is created. That's not the kind of wealth that we're talking about here. And I think our conscience can almost always tell us, did I earn this? And if so, I receive it gratefully, and I'll enjoy it. If I didn't earn it, even if I try to enjoy it, it'll have some kind of subtle consequence if I really didn't earn it. I won't feel good about it. So when we abide in asteya and know that we've whatever we say to be ours is whatever we've earned, and we enjoy it, we begin to receive the bounty that nature has. When we know that we're only willing to accept whatever we've earned, that's when generosity starts to flow. So nature is able to share only when we're able to receive it. We're able to receive it when we've learned how to earn it, when we are actively engaged in fulfilling our own purpose. It's a very subtle thing, but it makes complete sense that when you know that you've done your role, you're able to have the ease, the confidence to say that I'll receive whatever I'm supposed to receive. That's when all gems manifest. Gems really mean the best that nature has for us. Any human achievement that brings us joy is a gem. It's not just wealth. And look at it this way. When we talk about earning something that we really feel proud of, the things we feel proud of are the ones that we know that we worked hard to achieve. Very rarely do we treasure anything which just randomly fell in our lap. That's the kind of gem that the sutra is talking about. That when we learn the value of fulfilling our purpose, doing our role, and we know that we've earned something, we're able to receive the best. 238. A yogi established in brahmacharya gains virya, the capacity to transmit knowledge. So brahmacharya is almost always translated in the context of celibacy. But it's a gross mispositioning, because really the idea here is the idea of masterful engagement of all senses. Yoga has this idea of 10 senses, of which one of the 10 is procreation. That's what's received so much emphasis in the more conventional translations. But all 10 senses, sense of seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, and hearing, senses of knowledge that bring awareness in, and this sense of movement, manipulation, speech, procreation, and consumption are active senses that allow us to engage with the world in response to the information that we take in. All 10 of those senses need to be masterfully engaged, masterfully employed. All 10 of these senses quite often are on full-blown autopilot mode, completely driven by sense cravings, habits. Before we even know what we're doing, we're like 10 steps into something, and there's too much momentum to really break that cycle. Brahmacharya literally means walking in the light of higher consciousness, higher awareness, remembering our purpose. If we engage our senses with purpose, it's brahmacharya. Killing our senses, tying them down, making sure that they have no room to do anything is not brahmacharya. That's called crippling ourselves. But employing these senses, which are tremendous little like little nuclear reactors, highly dense seeds of power, engaging them mindfully with a purpose takes tremendous discipline and willpower. So brahmacharya is about self-discipline, using these senses mindfully and purposefully. It's not about self-torture. Now, unless we look at discipline in the right way, of course it'll feel like torture, because we don't know why. When an athlete trains and counts their caloric intake just so precisely, and how much they sleep, and how much they work out, what they think, and how they do everything, to someone who doesn't want to go to the Olympics, it would be horrible torture. But for that Olympic athlete, they know why they're doing it. It's extremely intense, beyond the level of what is normal, maybe even rational, maybe even healthy at times, but it is purpose-driven. They really derive a tremendous source of fulfillment from it. So we might not need to go that far, but the whole point is whatever we do with our senses, and really what that means is with our lifestyle, it should be purpose-driven. And as we do that, we unlock all of the power that's latent in the senses. The fact that these 10 senses can create a reality for us tells you how much power there is. That what we understand of ourselves and the world is almost exclusively in relation to what these 10 senses share with us. They create our reality for the most part until a deeper capacity within is awakened. For most people, that deeper part of the mind is asleep. For most people, our experience of reality is in context to these 10 senses. They create our reality. So imagine the power that allows them to create that reality, the power inbuilt in these senses and what it can do for you. Brahmacharya, purposefully using our senses, unlocks that power, which is what this sutra is calling virya. It's this indomitable will and vitality, extraordinary vitality. What it allows us to do is to earn the capacity to transmit knowledge. What does that mean? The senses are all about receiving knowledge and expressing. The whole purpose of the senses is so we can take in reality and contribute to reality by engaging with it, by doing something. When we master the power that lies behind the senses, we're truly able to share knowledge. Up until then, even when we think that we're engaged with the world, there's all these layers between us. We're never actually able to communicate. When I communicate, your brain, your sense organs, and then your brain, and then some deeper part of your brain, which is the sense itself, has to reassemble all of that information. So really what we're doing is exchanging information, largely through sound, and a little bit through sight, and smell, and a few other senses. We're passing information back and forth, which is why so often there's a miscommunication. The information is not received properly. It's not processed properly. We're not able to understand each other. And if it's something extremely factual, it's okay because we can reconstruct it. But what about more subtle forms of information, like emotions, ultimately wisdom? If there's anything which blocks our ability to transmit, we'll never really be able to convey that. There are many times in life where we want to be understood. Every human being wants to be understood, but especially once our consciousness expands and we have a sense of purpose, we need to share something before we go. Whatever we've understood, we want to share it. Being able to share it is tremendously important to us. And we can only do that effectively when we've masterfully engaged our senses and cultivated this virya. So a yogi is an embodiment of that spirit of guidance, teaching, nourishment. Every yogi wants to share that nourishment and guidance. To do so, we need virya, so that our senses, our speech, and all the other nine senses can convey not just information, but knowledge, and that knowledge is a living knowledge. Brahmacharya. Now, as a side note to brahmacharya, in addition to virya being the capacity to transmit knowledge, virya is that extraordinary force of vitality. On many, many more levels, the side effects of this virya are much more than just the capacity to transmit knowledge. We become powerful in the process as we transform our relationship to our senses and our lifestyle. Funny, the sutra doesn't even note that. That's like such a secondary side effect that it wasn't noted, but it's a big side effect from our worldly perspective, that if we're able to be in our body and have access to the power of our senses, it's like our capacity is multiplied manyfold. We're much, much more alive than we were before. And the irony there is that sometimes we think that to be alive, we need to really be out there and super overloaded with sensory engagement. Yogis say the opposite, that when you learn to moderate your sense engagement and bring discipline and purpose is the most important thing, purpose to it, your awareness of life, the richness of life that you receive through the senses is really magnified, not diminished. But it takes a complete change in perspective. And again, it's a process, not going to happen overnight. 239. With firmness in non-possessiveness comes complete understanding of the whyness of birth. So, aparigraha, non-possessiveness. Does this mean that we give everything away? No. It means that we transform our relationship, our attitude, our dependence to everything that we consider to be ours. Last session, I use the expression that make sure that our possessions don't possess us. It's a dependency on our achievements, our material possessions, which shrink our world. And think about where this dependence on our achievements, possessions comes from. It's a desire. Our desires are out of control. They take over, and we're more concerned about what we have and making sure it doesn't go away than actually enjoying it. We're not able to ever experience any fulfillment of those desires. Desire is what propels the wheel of karma. We spent a whole session talking about the wheel of karma. So aparigraha has to do with transforming this force behind the wheel of karma, this force of desire. When we learn to understand the desires that propel our world, our personal world, that is, our personal world of all of our achievements and possessions, we gain some power over that. And we're able to enjoy our possessions and eventually share them. Not dump them, throw them out, just abandon the house and then, leave the car there and then eventually it's towed away. But give it away. Use it and then give it away. When that happens, we begin to understand the nature of desire itself. When we understand the nature of desire, we understand that fundamental force which propels the wheel of karma. How we reached here, why, and where we're going. And that's exactly what this sutra says. Firmness in non-possessiveness brings complete understanding of whyness of birth. How we arrived here, and where we're going to go. Huge claim. Hard to understand. So the important thing is here, begin to practice some aparigraha and see what it tells us about our desires. See what kind of wisdom that brings. And imagine the kind of mind that was so clear about the nature of our desire that we could see to the force behind the desire. That's what this sutra is talking about. 240 onwards talk about the niyamas, the observances. First one is a little bit tricky, and it's two sutras together, 240 and 241, about shocha, purity. Literal translation of 240 is, from purity arises sensitivity to the unclear nature of one's own body. That leads to unmixing with others. Often this whole idea of purity, and even the literal translation of this, can give us the wrong impression that our body is dirty, something to be ashamed of, and we need to fix it quickly. But the important thing here is to first reflect on a number of things. What is it that brings impurity? And the commentary talks about two different categories of impurity, physical impurity and mental impurities. Our body is born pristine. Panditji likes to call it the innate wisdom of the body. It's manifest. And you can certainly see it in children, spontaneous healing capacity. They literally don't even smell often. It's a fragrant aroma. It's like pristine, totally able to just be perfect. And over time, something accumulates. Maybe the modern word might be toxins, toxicity. Anything which is an accumulation within the body of an external contaminant. It's not that it's bad, but it's not supposed to reside there. It's not supposed to be there. And the body's natural capacity to cleanse and nourish itself was impaired in some way. Something got in the way. And over time, all that unneeded matter, in the Ayurveda known as ama, accumulates, and it leads to imbalance. That is what we're calling physical impurity. It's simply something which shouldn't be in the body. It's not a bad thing, nothing to feel to judge ourselves about, but it's more important to understand how did it reach there. Some kind of imbalance in the body's innate capacity to cleanse and nourish itself took place, which led to this condition. We need to work with that. That's what we need to think about in terms of rediscovering our physical purity, removing these physical imbalances. The mental part is even more subtle and intriguing. Mental impurities are our samskaras. We spent so much time talking about this in relation to the kleshas in this book and then in the previous book study club about samskaras, these subtle tendencies of the mind. Anything which we accumulate in our mind, any identity, which is one that's nurtured by the kleshas, these afflictions, any identity which is nurtured by ignorance, distorted sense of self-identity, attachment, ego, or fear, attachment, aversion, or fear, is a mental contaminant. We don't really want it there, but we don't know that there's any other way of being. We need to purify our mind. That happens through the inner limbs of the eight limbs, meditation, essentially. Last half of 240 said that, actually the whole thing says, from purity arises sensitivity to the unclean nature of one's own body. It doesn't mean that we start to feel bad about ourselves and say, oh God, this is disgusting. We realize that a certain part of ourself has external unwanted tendencies and another part of ourself is more pristine. We are able to bring balance. We're able to genuinely support this cleansing and nourishing capacity and gravitate towards that part of ourself which we know to be our higher self, a part of ourself which reflects this purity. And it leads to unmixing with others. We're motivated to embrace the better part of ourself and leave behind the rest. What happens from there? 241. From purity arises the purity of our essential being, our buddhi, that discerning capacity of the mind. A positive mind, one-pointedness, victory over the senses, and the qualification for having direct experience of ourself. Big list. Once we purify our body and our mind, once we love our body and restore its innate wisdom by restoring this natural balance of cleansing and nourishing, our body is healed. Once we purify our mind by working hard to experience who we are through the path of meditation and see clearly that there's a part of ourself which is pristine and there's a part that we've introduced artificially, these samskaras, these identities that don't hold meaning for us, that are limiting. Once that happens, all these amazing things begin to manifest. It's a process. Purity is not an on or off state, this idea of shocha. It's a continuum of experience that leads us towards these qualities in 241. And it's amazing because they lead us into the rest of the niyamas. When you look at this list, things like victory over the senses and qualification for having direct experience of ourself, that naturally leads us to what comes next. Specifically 242. From contentment, which is santosha, comes happiness without equal. It's such a short verse and a short commentary because it's a very central truth that's almost in every spiritual tradition, every culture, that it's not what we have materially which makes us happy in the end, but our understanding of what those achievements mean. When we're able to be happy with whatever we receive and understand the relationship between that which we receive and the part, the thing within us, which is the enjoyer, we are able to be truly fulfilled. If the part in us which is able to enjoy is not present, no matter how much we have, we'll never be content. Most of the time when we earn achievements and earn material possessions, the part of us which is fully awake is our ego, because we worked really hard to get it, and we're, as soon as we achieve it, we're worried about losing it. Our ego is fully awake, the part of us which is defining itself by all of those possessions and experiences. But the experiencer in us, the enjoyer in us, is not allowed to come forward. Our ego is in the way. We're not able to appreciate what we have because we're worried about losing it. That's the biggest obstacle in finding contentment. Or we don't really understand what we have. Once we can be grateful for, and this is where gratitude comes in, we're not really aware of what we have. We're not grateful for it. Once we know what we have and how fortunate we are, no matter what that is, the what we receive is often less important than the fact that it's we've received it now. That's why a gift is wonderful no matter what it is, when it's given with love and received with gratitude. And that's, we've all experienced that. The simplest thing feels wonderful when it was given genuinely and received genuinely. That's what this santosha is all about. And if we can see everything in life as a gift somehow, rather than as a transaction, which is a very big challenge in the modern world, where all relationships have become transactional, measured by very external means of value. We have to put that aside and see everything as a gift, not as an accident, not as a bonus, but as something beautiful to be cherished. From that comes happiness without equal. Until we have that, we're really never content. This has a lot to do with desire as well, similar to aparigraha. The last three are words that we spent a good amount of time talking about in our very first session on Kriya Yoga: tapas, swadhyaya, and Ishwar Pranidhana. It's important to recognize that these three are an integral part of the niyamas, and as such, they're an integral part of the eight limbs. But they were introduced first in the context of Kriya Yoga, the heart of yoga. These three practices bring yoga to life. They bring yoga to life. Tapas usually means austerity, but the idea behind tapas is something much, much more rich. Tapas is that purpose-driven self-effort which allows us to shine. The literal meaning of tapas is shining glow, radiance. An extraordinary radiance that illuminates us from the inside out. The practice of tapas has to do with bringing discipline. So if there's a very close relationship with tapas and brahmacharya. Brahmacharya was a form of tapas, purpose-driven, self-effort, discipline that had to do with senses, with the senses specifically. Tapas here is quite a bit more broad, that we have to reflect on what our practice is. What are we trying to engage with so that we can shine, so that we can experience our inner capacity and really engage with it and overcome our resistance to that purpose-driven change. Often the heat comes from this resistance to this purpose-driven change. It's good resistance, it's good pain, good heat. There's a big difference between true pain and that feeling of being slightly stretched, our capacity being stretched by our tapas. How do we know that it's right? Because it's purpose-driven. Often what we think, you know, we have a very specific workout goal, I need to hit X number of reps. Is there a purpose behind that, or is that a somewhat arbitrary goal? So tapas can never lead to injury when we're mindfully growing our capacity and there's a purpose behind it, because the very awareness of the purpose will prevent us from going so far beyond our capacity that we end up taking many steps backward. This is not about self-imposed torture. This is about expanding our capacity through purpose-driven change. And the outcome of that purpose-driven change is unleashing a tremendous inner radiance, tapas, literally, the tapas, the glow within. When that happens, we see this glow. That glow is the radiance of our inner power. And what is that? The light of our buddhi, whatever is that deepest essence of our mind that discerns, that knows, that makes reality real. That begins to shine forth. That's where this idea of brilliance or glow comes from, tapas. When that happens, Sutra 243, from that, so first of all, I should go back to the beginning. Tapas destroys impurities. That purpose-driven change where we, through our discipline, overcome our resistance to change. That resistance to change is our attachment to our kleshas, our impurities. That's why there's resistance. Because some part of us likes it, actually, even though we know it's not for our good. So it's hard. One, that tapas begins to manifest, it destroys those impurities, this influence of the kleshas. Our buddhi shines through. We glow. We become radiant. Our capacity is becoming unlocked. Then in 243, from that come yogic accomplishments, literally siddhis. This is probably the only time that the word siddhi is used in these sutras. From that comes yogic accomplishments pertaining to the body and senses. Our body and senses are fully illuminated or begin to become illuminated by the power of our buddhi, by the power of our mind. Our body and our senses are vehicles to achieve the purpose of our inner being, our soul, if you will, our buddhi. The radiance of that buddhi shines through and we unlock all these amazing capacities in this vehicle of the body and senses. It's not that the body and senses overnight develop some new amazing capacity. They begin to express the power of the buddhi in a new way. We don't create these siddhis. The body and senses are manifesting the radiance that's now being allowed to shine through because the impurities have been purified, have been put aside. And the sutra goes into quite detail about the nature of these siddhis in two different categories, siddhis of the body and siddhis of the senses. Extraordinary siddhis. Beauty, charm, vitality, and self-healing power are the physical siddhis, for instance. Amazing things happen when we practice tapas. Tapas is a reflection of our commitment to purpose-driven change and overcoming the resistance to that change, which in effect is our attachment to our kleshas. The entire practice of yoga, the other limbs, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, meditation, the practice of yoga is a form of tapas when we undertake that in a purpose-driven way. And truthfully, forget those other limbs. These practices of the yamas and niyamas that we've already covered, it takes tremendous discipline, tremendous willpower. And that's actually where the most resistance to change comes from. Asana, pranayama, pratyahara, meditation, we see some resistance, but because there's an immediate feedback loop, we see something feels good, it's a little easier. These lifestyle elements, relationship to ourself and the world, a lot of resistance. So in many ways, the tapas we're talking about in this sutra is in regard to the yamas and niyamas. 244. Swadhyaya. From swadhyaya comes the opportunity to be in the company of bright beings of our choice. Swadhyaya is almost always translated as self-knowledge, self-reflection, learning who we are. The important point to reflect on here is what aspect of ourself. What this sutra is talking about is understanding who we are at our deeper levels. Beyond understanding who we are in our inner world, our mind, and whatever empowers our mind. And the commentary on this sutra makes a very clear statement about what swadhyaya is in a classical sense. Swadhyaya is japa, or repetition of mantras with purifying capacity like om and the study of scriptures. This statement requires some explanation. Otherwise, we're like, how is that self-knowledge? What is that all about? Study of scripture part can be confusing. A better word might be to go back to the original Sanskrit, Shastra. That source wisdom that has a self-revealing capacity. That source wisdom which embodies the direct experience of a seeker. When someone has known themselves and enjoyed that experience and wants to share it, what comes out is Shastra. When someone else knows themselves, that reflection can help us know who we are too, when we reflect on it, when we read it, study it, and internalize it. The first part of the statement, that swadhyaya is japa, a repetition of mantras that have a purifying capacity. That tells us a lot about what kind of mantra meditation we're talking about. The mantra needs to be an awakened living mantra, which has a capacity to profoundly touch us in a very deep place. A mantra itself is a vibrational, energetic reality that reflects a deep state of realization. The science of mantra is vast, but an essential way of looking at it is that a mantra is an encapsulation of that experience of samadhi, experience of pure self, which a seer had. And in that state, that experience crystallized in a pure vibration called a mantra. That vibration takes on a certain auditory form, a sound body, which we understand to be the sound of the mantra. But a mantra is more than the sound in the external sense. It's a unique energetic reality. Just like we're a being, we're a reality, a mantra is also like a reality. A reality that is maintains the essence of that experience of self. Japa of a mantra like that means to reflect on its meaning and to internalize that awareness in our own mind. Our mind is like a mirror. Our mind is an instrument that can be tuned to a certain resonant frequency. When the frequency of our mind, if you will, I'm using it slightly figuratively, when our mind is fully resonant with the vibration of the mantra, not necessarily the sound, but the experience of the mantra, that mantra allows our mind to see self in the way that the mantra embodies that experience of self from where it came. That experience of self is our self. That's the whole point. That the experience of self is one for all. That the seer who experienced that mantra saw the self. When we can allow our mind to be absorbed in that mantra, that experience of self will come forward. That experience of self that this mantra embodies is our capacity to experience ourself. That's why it's called swadhyaya, study of swa, one's own self. And that's why mantra is at the heart of swadhyaya, because a living mantra is a seed of self encapsulated in sound. And when our mind can rest in that sound, that experience of self comes forward. Self-study where we think about self is very different than a self-study where we experience self. That's why mantra is so highly prized in this case. Now, what happens when we achieve or when we experience swadhyaya? From there comes the opportunity to be in the company of bright beings. There's a lot in the commentary in this book, and I'll boil it down to one or two very important points. Just like mantra is the essence of self, what's being described here as the company of bright beings, the word for bright being that's actually used here is Ishtadevata. And the translation of that word from this commentary on page 214 is the essential attribute which makes a bright being bright, the intrinsic brilliance of a bright being. The word bright being is consciousness. The central brilliance of consciousness. But in a somewhat personalized way, in the way that we're able to experience it. That's why it's Ishta Devata. Pure consciousness that is resonant with what our mind is able to perceive and experience. We experience consciousness in a way which we can relate to through Swadhyaya. That experience of consciousness in a way that we can relate to it, which is defined here as Ishta Devata, is the same as the essence of mantra, essence of pure experience. Essence of experience that is mantra is that intrinsic brilliance of consciousness. Ishta Devata is synonymous with the essence of mantra, which is why when you practice that kind of mantra meditation, which has at its goal to experience self, we have the opportunity to be in the company of that embodiment of consciousness called Ishta Devata. This one is a little bit esoteric or mystical. What this is trying to inspire us is that the path of mantra meditation and self-reflection through source wisdom gives us the opportunity to not intellectually know who we are, but to experientially know who we are. That's why it's so important. We're trying to feel who we are at deeper levels, not just think about it. It becomes real then. And that very naturally leads us to the final sutra, Ishvara Pranidhana. When we're able to genuinely experience ourself, and it begins with perhaps more superficial layers of ourself, but eventually, Swadhyaya leads us to experience our deepest self, our pure buddhi, buddhi sattva, the essence of our mind. That essence of our mind is, it might be our Ishta Devata, that essential brilliance of consciousness. It might be the expression of that pure awareness that the mantra embodies. It's something that allows us to know who we are without any limitations. One of the things that happens is we begin to see ourselves in relation to the whole. It's still an experience of ourself, but we begin to realize that there's a very unique relationship that we have to this reality. We are a unique individual being, some kind of discrete bubble of consciousness. We experience ourselves, and it's profound, it's rich, it's extraordinary. And we begin to see that we are held in something much bigger. So much of our time in the world is actually creating all these small identities, which are in many ways an infinite number of ways that we define and limit ourselves. I am a house with 5 bedrooms. I am a car, you know, of such and such kind. I am this and I am this. That's not actually expanding, it's shrinking. Through Swadhyaya, we grow, but we realize that no matter how big we grow, we're growing within a much, much richer reality. And we wonder what that is. And that leads to a very profound discussion on Ishvara that we spent a lot of time talking about in the first book study club, Sutras 123 to 129, where Ishvara is understood to be higher reality. Just like our personal world is a unique bubble of reality, Ishvara is a reality that's completely unbound, free. Free from any influence of the kleshas, free from all karma, outcome of karma, and any karmic vehicle that propels one life to the next forever. Complete freedom. An infinitely vast, rich field of creative intelligence from which all potential arises. Pure purpose. Ishvara is more than a concept, it's a reality. But for the sake of study, Ishvara is a concept, it's a word. So we need to really internalize what this is all about. And that can only come through Swadhyaya. Swadhyaya, when we know ourself, we begin to see, is it possible that there is a self of all selves? Is there something that is so essential that it allows me, as my experience of my personal understanding of self, to relate to everything else. It can't be intellectual, it has to be experiential. That continual process of growth is what samadhi, stages of samadhi are all about. And ultimately we realize that we are held in a reality far, far bigger than anything we could ever experience in a limited way, even through the limitless, even through the extraordinary capacity of our mind. Our mind is held in something bigger. That's called Ishvara. And this idea of trustful surrender means that we reach the end of human effort. We realize that we've understood ourself, but the essence of self, it's like the drop trying to have the ocean fit into it. We know where we come from, and essentially it's the same, and yet to experience that totality, we need to allow ourselves to be embraced by it. From our perspective, we're surrendering ourselves to that reality. From the perspective of that reality, we're allowing ourselves to be embraced by it. So trustful surrender and complete embrace are two sides of the same experience. That experience can only come out of a genuine and completely mature experience of all of the other yamas and niyamas, but particularly tapas and swadhyaya that culminate in this experience of Ishwar Pranidhana. From that Ishwar Pranidhana comes samadhi. Samadhi is the state of being fully held, where self-effort ends and grace dawns. So it's the, in many ways, it's the culmination. In fact, that's exactly where Samadhipada, the first book of the Yoga Sutra, ended. And it's where the entire Yoga Sutra will end in chapter 4. So it's a definitive statement. But in the context here of the yamas and niyamas, it's intriguing because this sutra 245 is almost an exact replica of 123. And it's very unusual in a sutra-style text to repeat oneself. It shows how important it is. And that this is, for now, it's just an idea. It's a principle. But it's at the very heart of what practice is all about. And once we can bring it into practice, it allows us to really reach that culmination. That's the final of these 10. And it gives a great sense of completion. But really, it's important to remember that this Sutra 245 is the conclusion of the yamas and niyamas. Taken in their totality, they help us understand the foundation upon which the remaining limbs are built and expressed and practiced. And that's where we'll pick up next week. Thank you.